How would you like to travel to a place which is neither real nor unreal? A place where reality has the unbelievability of a dream and dreams the impact of reality. Then tune in to Surreality Bites on Mind's Eye Radio. We'll visit the Valley of the Dead Elms and the capital of Strange, watch an arm float down a river. That's Surreality Bites on Mind's Eye Radio. It's radio within reach. Surrealism declares that it is able, by its own means, to uproot thought from an increasingly cruel state of thraldom, to steer it back onto the path of total comprehension, return it to its original purity. André Breton, Second Manifesto of Surrealism. Welcome to Surreality Bites from Mind's Eye Radio, the most creative hour on the air. I'm your host, Greg Willard. In the next hour, we'll venture into the Neverland between reality and fantasy. We'll visit the Valley of the Dead Elms and the capital of Strange, watch an arm float down a river, and almost have sex with a Touareg. All that and much more through original fiction, poetry, music, and essays of the Mind's Eye Radio Collective of Madison, Wisconsin. Join us on a strange and fantastic journey. Perhaps the oddest thing about strangeness is that if we live around it long enough, we lose our ability to tell what's normal and what's odd. It's a phenomenon that writer Fran Zell discusses in her essay, The Capital of Strange.
Strange? You want strange? I grew up in the capital of strange. I can tell you about strange. So once upon a time there was an accountant who worked nights and slept days and spent most of the time in between in his own private bathroom smoking and reading right-wing manifestos while his wife fretted in the kitchen downstairs trying to cook the perfect 3-minute egg for his breakfast. If location, location, location was everything for the husband in the bathroom upstairs, timing, timing, timing was everything for the wife in the kitchen. How could she get that egg to come out just the way her husband liked it if she had no idea when he was finally going to make his appearance at the table? And days went by, and months, and years, and the egg never did come out right enough. But the wife didn't stop trying, and pretty soon she got just as rubbery as the egg, complaining to the kids about what an awful lot she had in life, and why didn't her husband ever emerge from the bathroom before his egg congealed. Why, you may very well ask yourself, why didn't the wife, who happened to be my mother, tell the husband, who happened to be my father, to cook his own eggs? Why didn't the husband choose cereal from a box? Probably they were just bored and a little disappointed with the way life had turned out, and the daily battle of the egg added gusto. But I've always been a little differently able because of that darn egg. Not very good at figuring out what's strange and what isn't. Like, just the other day, I was crossing the street and a guy came running from the opposite direction chasing a cabbage. He ran right into me, hard, like a rugby player, leaving me bruised and confused as to why a grown person would run into the middle of the street without looking at anything but a rolling cabbage. "Why don't you look where you're going?" I asked the man. He didn't reply. He just walked away with his cabbage. And the week before that, I was riding my bicycle down a quiet street and came upon two middle-aged women locked in a sisterly embrace. One of the women was crying. "Are you crying?" the tearful one asked the other, taking a step back to see for herself. And the other woman said no. No, she wasn't crying. With that, the tearful one began to shriek shamelessly. You never cried for me. You never cried for me. And what had looked for a moment like love suddenly looked hateful. Once I was a guest at a Thanksgiving dinner where a married attorney with a child on the way suddenly scolded his mother loudly. You didn't breastfeed me, he proclaimed miserably. Tough titty, his mom replied without missing a sip of her martini, while the rest of us pretended no one had said anything unusual to anyone. I had a friend who threw a sweet 16 party for her cat. I had a friend who put her dog to sleep when she got divorced because she didn't think the creature would adjust to a new home. I knew someone who gift-wrapped a dead cat and stored it in the garage over the winter. Is any of this strange or the least bit paranormal? What about the couple who got married after living together for 32 years and didn't tell anyone because they'd let on that they were married and didn't want to upset the friends who wouldn't have been their friends all those years had they known they were actually just living together? And if too many days go by and I don't write a poem or an essay or at least part of a story, I feel sad and lost within myself and unable to cope with all the strangeness. Is that strange? Would somebody please tell me what's normal? This is Fran Zell for Mind's Eye Radio.
Surrealism was an art movement advanced by a group of artists in Paris during the 1920s, which included André Breton, Louis Bunuel, Salvador Dali, Max Ernst, and Man Ray. Breton wrote in the Surrealist Manifesto of 1924 that surrealism aimed to unite dream and reality into a kind of absolute reality, a surreality. Informed by Sigmund Freud's theories of psychoanalysis, the artist investigated the unconscious as a creative force. They recorded dream imagery in their art, explored the expressive potential of chance juxtapositions, and practiced psychic automatism, a stream of consciousness method of composing poetry and art. We'll hear some excerpts from Breton's Surrealist Manifesto throughout the show. Where does reality stop and surreality start? You be the judge, in Evie Thompson's story, The Arm.
I was showering when I first noticed it. The upper end of my right arm, near the shoulder, felt thinner. The flesh felt looser somehow. You are such a hypochondriac, I told myself, and forgot about it entirely for several days. Then I was chopping onions at the breadboard, and I noticed my wrist just didn't seem to want to push down. I'd say wasn't pushing down, but in the light of later events, that wouldn't be as accurate. The loss of control over the whole arm got steadily worse, and I became alarmed enough to set up an appointment to see my doctor. But the situation became so strange that I canceled the appointment, afraid any medical person would have me committed. I believe in imaging, you know, creating a mental image of what you want parts of your body to do. And mentally, I told that arm to relay the messages along the nerves to the muscles, and I told the muscles to respond. The day it happened, I was having a particularly bad time. It was hot and muggy, and I got really irritated at the lack of response from my right hand as I wrote out checks to pay the bills. It was almost like it was fighting me. "You clumsy, stupid thing," I said. It came so fast. I didn't know at first what had happened. My glasses hit the floor, and I felt stunned for a moment. But as memory came back, I realized my right elbow had drawn back, and the hand had slapped me across the face, hard. I went in on my bed, and I bawled. As I pulled myself together, I knew I couldn't tell anyone about this. I had moments when I couldn't believe what was happening myself. The area around the upper right arm continued to grow thinner, and it seemed itchy. The arm became progressively more rebellious. It would scarcely cooperate for such simple things as turning the car key in the ignition. One day, when I was struggling to get my blouse sleeve over that arm, I got so angry I slapped my right hand as hard as I could. It reached over and raked my left arm with its fingernails, leaving long scratches. It refused to help wash the wounds at the sink. But when I stepped into the shower, it seemed to relent a little and rubbed soap over the area to clean the wounds. Oddly, I came to accept the situation. I even monitored with some curiosity the development of four lumps just below the thinned-out area on the arm, a round one and three long, thin ones, and I thought I saw what looked like eyes and a mouth forming on the round one. About this time, I found myself walking often along the river. I was surprised by a desire to join the swimmers at the beach. I hate getting into a swimsuit. But the urge was almost overwhelming. So one morning, just before dawn, I searched out an old swimsuit and stuffed myself into it. I hoped it would be less embarrassing before other swimmers arrived and could see the fat, and worse yet, the arm now dangling by a slim rope of flesh and with the strange lumps sticking out. As I got into the water, I glanced at the round lump. It now had clear, distinguishable facial features, and the long appendages were taking on the form of an arm and two legs, and these were all growing rapidly. I lay back and floated with the current. Overhead were wonderful light effects from the rising sun. I felt a slight tug at my shoulder, and looking over, discovered that the arm had separated from me, and I was growing a new arm. The separated arm's body was now complete and well-proportioned. The arm floated by my side. I felt a tenderness for it, and so I accompanied it protectively for a while. When I saw it negotiate with ease around a half-submerged log, I said goodbye and pulled myself up on the bank. The arm waved and floated on down the river. This is Evie Thompson for Mind's Eye Radio.
You're listening to Surreality Bites on Mind's Eye Radio. I'm Greg Willard. Now, what makes something surreal and not just odd is the juxtaposition of perfectly ordinary and perfectly extraordinary. Poet Fran Rahl captures all of this in her poem.
Sleepily, I cross to the stairs. Feel for the switch I know is there. The genie in the lamp waiting for a touch. And when God said, "Let there be light," did this huge finger feel around in the dark for the switch? This is Fran Rahl for Mind's Eye Radio.
In the late summer of 1987, my husband and I found the house of our dreams.
Madison writer Norma Gay Pruitt.
A narrow Victorian located right across the street from us. It had all the gingerbread a person could ever ask. We hadn't been living in our house long enough to have met this woman who had been born, lived, and died in that house. But ever so often, we felt her presence. One morning, I awoke to the comforting smell of bread baking. I began to sense her presence everywhere, but especially in her earthly possessions, left in the attic for us to sort. To Helen, the end of the story. This is the part I tell my long-suffering spouse, where the struggling young couple finds the tiny box at the bottom of the trash hauled back-breakingly from the 110-year-old house. Therein, the diamond, long forgotten, nestled in the folds of the respectable serge pocket. Or I'd settle for the version where it's a gold locket, holding a few strands of someone's beard, a locket she can't bear to look at, much less to open. But instead, we toil 3 hours and find our Helen Olson was a scholar, yet a proper Victorian girl. She kept playbills and loving, spidery script letters on stationery, onion-thin, from the old Blackstone Hotel, Chicago. Girlfriends, now moldering, saying, "You are a scandal, Helen, don't you know? Driving a rental Ford." And Myrtle had the smallpox, and the city inoculated the whole neighborhood, and mine became infected. Pa's did not. Topeka and Santa Fe timetables with sepia noble savages perched on rocks, watching the trains go by, and lifetimes of newspaper bundled scraps of fabric marked with things like coat, 1924, and references in notes to making perfume from the leaves of sweet peas. Brown silk gloves that reached halfway up the thin upper arm, and a racy bustier you must never have worn, in embroidered blue that might barely make it round my thigh. I don't think I'll even try. Class notes and a reference to your thesis binding, $1.50, name, the regional variations of milk cow production in several Wisconsin counties. One term paper simply called Oceans. Narrow that to a stream, my English teacher self wants to scream. And then a stenciled yellow box marked in pencil, 72 cents. It once held narcissus bulbs and bowl. Some season long gone by, now a pleasant odor and this verse. Water well these little bulbs, and they will surely do their best to bear my greetings and best wishes on to you. My heart a tree full of wrens, I lift the lid and see mementos of a dance and a bridge party, Alpha Xi Delta, March 19, 1921. Your dance card lists several, including Jack, in quotation marks, as if he's not really Jack, but that's his nom de danse. I just know he was a scoundrel, Helen. We know you never married. Just before your quiet death, before we newcomers knew your name, we'd see you profiled in the hand-carved doorway or staring from your window. Oh, you had lots of visitors, but none of them was Jack. We felt we knew that. Then, last silly bridge score card removed, in the bottom, the last corner to be moved in 75 years, this ring. It's tiny, it's silver and engraved. I thank you, Helen. My letter to your family went unanswered, so I place this ring on my own smallest finger. If I see Jack, I'll be sure to shun him, but you should know that in the deepest way, you and I are wed. This is Norma Gay Pruitt, thanking you, Helen.
The simplest surrealist act consists of dashing down into the street, pistol in hand, and firing blindly, as fast as you can pull the trigger, into the crowd. André Breton, Second Manifesto of Surrealism. Some people might view a surreal event as an intrusion on their reality, but writer Jackie Wilson recalls a time in her childhood when it was a gift.
My strange and surreal experience. The year I turned 13, our 10-year-old dachshund dog Penny had to be euthanized because of rotting teeth. I hadn't even known she was going to be put away. My parents had told me she was just going in for routine treatment and would be back, and I was heartbroken. We'd had her since I was 3, and I couldn't imagine life without her. I wanted her to have some kind of burial at least, but she died at the vet's, and my mother, who isn't sentimental, insisted it was downright silly to have a burial service for a dog. She'd told me when Penny was euthanized, for heaven's sake. What more did I want? Both my parents impatiently told me several times that animals die, that's just the way it is, and to quit crying and get over it. Penny and I had had a favorite route whenever I took her out for walks. It wound around our neighborhood and through a large tract of undeveloped meadow on top of a hill. It took me over a month to be able to go over that route again, but finally I summoned up my courage and went one Sunday, the day we usually took our walks together. I didn't want to go, but I felt I was leaving something undone, almost as if something was pulling me. It was a lovely spring day with brilliant sunshine and just warm enough to be comfortable without a coat, so I slipped out of the house feeling emotionally suspended somehow, as if I really wasn't doing this at all. I hurried quickly through the field when I got to it, trying not to think of Penny and how much she loved to stop and play and roll around here. As I stepped out onto the road beside it, I saw something on the ground. I bent down and picked it up. At first it looked like a piece of paper, but then I saw it was a little white plastic animal. I looked more closely. It was a dog, a dachshund, standing with head cocked as if listening to something. A pose I had seen Penny in many times. I went straight home and hid that little plastic dog in the top dresser drawer in my room where my mother wouldn't find it. I looked at it whenever I missed Penny, which was often. It finally disappeared, and I can't remember what happened to it, but I've always felt it was Penny's way of communicating with me, of telling me she was all right and reaching out to take care of me when nobody else would. This is Jackie Wilson for Mind's Eye Radio.
The Sign and the Encounter.
Madison Ryder, Esther Cameron.
I had come over to Germany in the fall of 1969 for a year's dissertation research, the subject of my dissertation being then a living poet, Paul Celan. He did not live in Germany, but in Paris. He was a Holocaust survivor. My dissertation professor, who knew him slightly, doubtless expected that I would contact him at the beginning of my stay and perhaps confer with him several times in the year. But I put off the contact, without asking myself why. For Rilke's saying that beauty is only the beginning of terror was never truer than in this case. Celan's poems speak from under the shadow. Nevertheless, they reach out, toward other humans, toward nature, even toward God, in a way that it is both skeptical and mystical. Early on, my professor had asked me whom they reminded me of. Sylvia Plath, I had answered without thinking. I knew I had to meet the man who wrote those poems, but on some level must have questioned whether I could bear it. Late in the spring, I finally wrote a short letter to Celan, requesting an interview, which was granted. The interview would take place on my way back to the States. At the last minute, I became ill and had to reschedule the interview. Finally, on the morning of August 4th, 1969, I set out and almost didn't get there. I had made plane reservations with a travel agency, but when I arrived at the Berlin airport early in the morning, the reservations were not on hand. The travel agency would not open until after the flight had left. Fortunately, there was still space on the flight, and I could buy another ticket. We took off. 15 minutes later, the plane turned back to Berlin for repairs. I made the connection at Stuttgart by a hair's breadth. On arriving in Paris, I went to the hotel which the German travel agency had booked for me. It was a very old hotel, dusty and decrepit. The uneven floors and stairs were covered with a deep blood-red carpeting, whose surface was threaded with gray dust. There was no elevator. My room was on the 6th story. Dismayed, I nevertheless went up to the room, opened my suitcase, took out a few things, and went downstairs to pay. The proprietress turned out to be an old woman, a perfectly ordinary Sephardic Jew, as I know now. She had dyed black hair, what seemed to me then a gypsyish kind of dress, and a small gold Star of David around her neck. Ever since childhood, for no evident reason, the six-pointed star had inspired a secret terror in me, and to see it on that occasion was too much. I sat down and explained in a voice I tried to make firm that I had been ill and did not have the strength to walk up six flights of stairs. The proprietress said that there were no other rooms in the hotel, but the family had another hotel a few streets away, more modern. She sent a young man up to repack my suitcase. In a short time, I found myself transferred to the other hotel, which was much newer and cleaner. My new room was only a short flight up from the street. But I didn't escape the Star of David. Large, gold, plastic, six-pointed stars were attached to the room keys. So I rested for an hour or so and went to the interview. A conversation hard to report, in which little was said directly, but much was hinted at, or seems to me to have been hinted at. At one point I stammered that I had seen signs, and he said, "Oh?" in a tone of alertness. But I could not speak of the old woman with the gold star, and he changed the subject. I felt in that interview the weight of the world that pressed on his consciousness, not only as a survivor of the Holocaust, but as a thinker and censor of the future. And I felt, too, the power of that concentration with which he was trying, despite everything, to see and to show a way. And at rare moments, a touch of unspeakable delight. The interview seems to me now to have been not an incident that occurred toward the midpoint of my life, but rather the originating point from which radiate all its significant incidents, my childhood fear of the Star of David, as well as my later conversion to Judaism, and poetic meditations on the six-pointed star and its central hexagon. In the fall of 1970, a few months after the death of Paul Celan, struggling to explain to someone what this encounter had meant to me, I thought of the hotel proprietress in Paris with her gold six-pointed star. The words came to me. God is an author with a heavy-handed sense of symbolism. This is Esther Cameron from Mind's Eye Radio.
Your computer has a protocol it follows when it starts up, like you rising groggy in the morning, turning off the alarm, pouring the coffee, and perusing the paper. It greets you with email and a vast web of information that spins toward you, a confusion of choices, like a combination of the tabloids and television. Your computer opens programs like someone who is always getting the door for you, slipping you the easy compliment, Eddie Haskell style, and thanking you and thanking you, endlessly thanking you. It wants to appear user-friendly, but it has conflicts that need addressing and issues to be resolved. Something is always running in the background, a personal agenda like gossip or fate waiting to stop you. Your computer stores old arguments to bring up later with illegal operations you may be cited for, or fatal exception errors that might spell doom, even if the spell checker has been disabled. It capitalizes words you do not wish to capitalize, corrects your grammar like your high school English teacher who thought Rod McEwen was a poet and that E.E. Cummings needed a lesson in punctuation. Your computer feels it knows what is best, and this morning it boots up Buddha-like with a Zen riddle for you. Keyboard not detected. Press F1 to continue. You stare at the F1 key on your keyboard that no longer exists, and you must decide if you wish to accept this challenge to find the virtual keyboard and press the F1 key that will let this life continue. This is Lynn Patrick Smith for Mind's Eye Radio.
How many strange or surreal events can you recall in your life? Writer Louise Mancuso counts two, both of which left indelible marks on her life.
It's 1969, and I am in Lilydale, New York, where psychics gather every summer. People come from all over the world to hear them speak and have one-on-one readings. The psychics are famous, and this place, I am told, brought here by a friend who was a former novice in the religious order she and I once belonged to. Leaving the monastery had thrown us both for a loop. We were looking for answers, but I did not particularly want them to come from Lilydale. My thinking, like a lot of people's, was that psychics were, for the most part, crazy, conniving, not an honest one in the bunch, no matter how much one might want to believe. I go only because Ada believes it will help. There is a souvenir stand inside the entrance gate. Most everyone stops there. It is the main attraction as you enter, the first thing you see. My friend and I are talking about what we are expecting from being here. Others are talking about the same thing. If there were microphones and cameras hidden in that area, the psychics would know a lot about us and why we were there. This thought enters my mind as I watch the sellers behind the souvenir stand watch us. I tell my friend Ada how I wish I knew what to do with my life. In 1964, I had gone to live with my grandmother in California a month after I left the monastery. I have been so patient, I tell Ada. I didn't want to go back home after leaving the monastery, but Reverend Mother wouldn't let me go unless I went back with my father and brother who had come to take me. And here I am, 5 years later, back in Buffalo living with them. I know, Ada says. We check the schedule for that day and head towards the huge tent where several well-known psychics will be talking and picking out people in the audience to give impromptu readings for. Maybe we'll get lucky, Ada says. Maybe they'll pick us. She says this because neither she nor I can afford the price of a one-on-one reading. We go into the tent that is filled almost to capacity. There are two seats at the end of one row, 6 rows in from the front. We take those and settle in, a bit on edge, but caught up in the general excitement. An unassuming woman in a rather drab dress steps forward and tells how Lilydale got started, the backgrounds of some of the people involved. She is very pleased to reiterate that this year they have among them, as their colleague, a woman who was a college graduate. The college graduate is introduced, is young, round-faced, and bright-eyed. She goes back to her seat. Then the speaker starts to point at different people in the audience, telling them so-and-so is here in the room and wants to tell them something. "Do you know someone with the initial M?" she asks the woman towards the back. "Is it Miriam? She says for you not to worry about your son. He will be all right." The woman in back is pleased, knows who Miriam is and why she said for her not to worry. And then another person is pointed to and words spoken to her from other visitors from beyond. And everyone is pleased. They are all pleased. And then she points to me. She says, "There is a woman here with the initial L who wants to tell you that, yes, you have indeed been patient. Do you know who L is?" I draw a blank. I say, "No. My name begins with L, but I can't think of anyone I know with that initial who died." I shake my head no, as the psychic keeps mentioning other names, other initials, and I am saying no, and sinking further down in my seat, wishing to be anywhere but there and for her to turn her attention elsewhere. I feel some kind of energy in the room, can see and feel concentric circles pulling me down, wanting me to let go, but I won't do it. No, I keep saying to myself, no, no, no. Then it passes, and the woman has passed on to someone else, and I am shaky as Ada and I leave the tent at the end of the talk. I tell her what I experienced and ask if anything like that happened to her. She says, "No." And I am wondering what would have happened if I had let myself go. Would I have been catapulted onto some higher spiritual plane? Would beings from beyond inhabit my body? Would I be the next new psychic of Lilydale, introduced as an actual former nun? Or would I be consenting instead to letting myself go completely and utterly mad, turning myself over to the forces of darkness? After leaving the tent and heading back towards the gate, Ada and I pass the college-educated psychic. She stops and smiles at me, and Ada goes on ahead, assuming I would want to stop and talk with her. The psychic is friendly. Looks like she knows me. Looks like maybe she would have some answers. So I smile and stay and try to tell her what I experienced inside the tent. But I am frightened and stop myself, recalling what occurred while I was still in the monastery, meditating in my cell on a Sunday morning. I had had a sudden insight, a technicolor vision, if you will, of the oneness of every animate and inanimate object on earth. Each tree, each rock, the minutest of substance, had its own voice, its own reason for being, and was filled with joy knowing they were a part of the whole. I remember bursting with excitement and immediately going to search for the mistress of novices so I could tell her of this wonder. But when I found her and had finished speaking, I recall her putting her finger to her lips and telling me, "Shh, keep this to yourself. If you tell anyone else, they will think you're crazy." I didn't understand. "But hasn't everyone who meditates experienced this?" I asked, thinking that now I was like everyone else in the monastery, that I had finally found what true meditation was. But when I asked Mother if she had experienced that, I could see the hurt in her eyes as she said, "No," then turned and walked away from me. And now, here was this young psychic, looking at me expectantly, then with puzzlement, as I shake my head and turn and walk away. On the way home in the car, Ada and I are mostly silent, our thoughts still back at Lilydale and the things that transpired in the tent. I go over and over in my mind about that first initial L the psychic mentioned, but I can't think of any names to fit. My two grandfathers had died, neither with the initial L, and I couldn't remember any of the other names or initials the psychic mentioned. But wait, there it was. My other grandmother, my father's mother, who died of a sudden heart attack at the age of 40, 2 years before I was born. It was for her I was named. My grandmother in California had been telling me about my grandmother Louise, about how close they were, how she died so unexpectedly before Grandma Rose could make it up the steps of the hospital to see her. The psychics couldn't have known that. Ada and I had never talked about any of that at all. This is Louise with an L. Mancuso, still wondering and waiting.
And you're listening to Surreality Bites on Mind's Eye Radio.
Land mined. All weapons aren't meant to kill. In fact, the most effective weapons are often the ones that incapacitate your enemy's body or terrorize his mind. Land mines are very definitely weapons of this sort. You don't know when it's going to go off. Drink to me only with thine eyes, and I will pledge with mine. This land is your land. This land is mine land. Listen to the raucous call of the mine bird. You've got your coal miner, your gold miner, your silver miner, and then you've got your land miner. True generosity is when what's mine is yours. Mine, land, mine, Kampf, Chow mine, land, mine, mind, land. Mind, 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 going out of my mind. The element, part, or process in a human or other conscious being that reasons, thinks, feels, wills, perceives, judges. The totality of conscious and unconscious mental processes and activities. Intellect or understanding, especially as distinguished from the emotions and will. Intelligence, a person considered with reference to intellectual power, the great minds of the day. Intellectual power or ability, reason, sanity, or sound mental condition, to lose one's mind. Opinion, view, or sentiments, to change one's mind. Inclination, intention, or desire, to be of a mind, to listen. Remembrance or recollection, memory, to call to mind. The party put me in mind of my college days. Psychic or spiritual being as opposed to matter, a conscious or intelligent agency or being. An awareness of a mind ordering the universe, attention, thoughts. He can't keep his mind on his studies. Oh, he's just like that. Just pay him no mind. To pay attention to heed, or obey, to apply oneself, or attend to mind one's own business, to look after, take care of, tend, to mind the baby, to be careful, cautious, or wary about, to feel disturbed or inconvenienced by, as in I hope you don't mind the interruption, to regard as concerning oneself or as mattering, don't mind his bluntness, to perceive or notice, to remember, to remind, to pay attention to obey, to take notice, observe or understand, to care, feel, concern or object, often to object or to regard a thing as concerning oneself or as mattering, you mustn't mind about this. Oh, to be of one's mind, to be of two minds, to bear or keep in mind, to have half a mind to have it on one's mind, to be out of one's mind, insane, mad, emotionally overwhelmed, frantic, out of my mind, with worry, out of my mind.
That was the R. Virgil Ellis and Algiwer duo with Landmind off their first World Feast CD. And you're listening to Surreality Bites on Mind's Eye Radio. Surrealism, as I envision it, proclaims loudly enough our absolute nonconformity that there may be no question of calling it, in the case against the real world, as a witness for the defense. It could only account, on the contrary, for the complete state of distraction which we hope to attain here below. Kant's absent-mindedness about women, Pasteur's absent-mindedness about grapes, Curie's absent-mindedness about vehicles are, in this respect, deeply symptomatic. André Breton, Surrealist Manifesto. If surreality begins with the blending of dreams with reality, surely we should welcome the opportunity to make a dream come true. Here's writer and geologist Elena Tabachnik.
As a teenager during the 60s sexual revolution, I fantasized about a sort of sexual junior year abroad, as a prostitute in Amsterdam, where prostitution was legal, government regulated, and relatively safe in those days before AIDS. I thought it would be cool to enjoy my designated sex object role by dominating society with it, like that New York madam who wrote the book. Unfortunately, even the thought of being kissed by strangers made me sick. But I figured it was an adult thing and I'd grow into it. All I had to do was wait. At 25, I was still waiting. By that time, my sex life had displayed all the excitement of your average soap dish. But I didn't give up hope. Surely my great sex conversion was just around the corner. Then my mother organized a trip to the Sahara. This included a Land Rover drive over roadless desert between the towns of Tamanrasset and Djennet. 5 Touareg men served as our guides, drivers, cooks, and all-round caretakers. Tuaregs were a tribe of warriors, the scourge of the desert as they charged camels across the sand, swords or rifles raised, blue and white robes billowing, romantic dark eyes flashing. When camel wars became unpopular, many Tuaregs turned to the tourist trade. On our fourth day out, we stopped under a stark granite ridge. My eyes burned with the clarity of ragged rocks, hunched reptilian against an infinitely blue sky. So as everyone chattered and milled around, I wandered off to look at samples with my geology hand lens. I'd spent a lot of the trip talking to a guide named Embarek. He was funny and intelligent, with a strong, aristocratic face, like carved and polished wood. Embarek joined me as I walked. We stared at rock pieces on the ground. Then he said, "Sex is good with a Tuareg," and a radiant smile bared his brown and broken teeth. All the Tuaregs had rotten teeth, so I guess kissing wouldn't have been a major part of that good sex. Yet here was my big chance. Sex with one of the warrior Tuaregs, now that qualified as adventure. "Oh," I cried, "look at this rock!" I scooped a rock off the ground. "Are those feldspar crystals?" "You must try sex with a Tuareg," Embarek said. I flipped a rock over with the toe of my boot, then bent to pick it up. I held it to my face and examined it through the lens. "This doesn't have any feldspar." And so our conversation continued. When we got back to the Land Rovers, Embarek leaned to whisper in my ear, "Tomorrow in Jeannette, I'll take you to a dance." "I have to stay with my mother," I mumbled, turning my head away. Now that is not as lame an excuse as it sounds, because good women in Muslim countries do not stray from the embrace of family. But still, what did it say about me that I needed it? When the tour stopped for lunch, Embarek showed me pictures of tourist women he had given pleasure to. One was a leggy blonde, German or Swedish or Swiss. She leaned gracefully against a Land Rover in khaki skirt and romantic, wide-brimmed hat. I looked through the pictures and handed them back to him. He wasn't going to sway me, even with such excellent references, because it wasn't that kind of problem. I only wished I could be like the leggy German and have sex with a Tuareg purely for the adventure of it. But wishing didn't change anything. From then on, I avoided Embarek, not because he was unpleasant. In fact, he was sweet and incessantly polite. But his attention made my future so painfully, irrefutably clear. I would have to live my life as the woman who could not have sex with a Tuareg. Because when it came to sex, I was a hopeless prude, and always would be. In today's world, when a third of adults have HIV in parts of Africa, I suppose I ought to be grateful. But it seemed a dreadful hard realization at the time. This is Elena Tabachnik for Mind's Eye Radio.
From the depths of the Saharan Desert to the Wisconsin countryside, you can never tell when surreality is going to step up and bite you. One day, all poet Ken Haynes wanted to do was chop firewood. But then he found himself in the Valley of Dead Elms.
The old farmer said, "Never go to the Valley of Dead Elms. Gnarled, twisted, arthritic, creaking, screaming, barkless, smooth and gray, knotted joints, branches, trunks, no longer able to shade or intertwine each other's finger-like limbs to form canopies of cool, green translucence, since the dreaded disease escaped from its subterranean sleep of three human generations, or one bat of a tree's eye. They meant heat to me, twisted, stubborn logs for the stove on brittle January evenings, when all the oak and hickory is gone, even as my notion of their deadness faded with each pull of the chainsaw cord. And it started, and the trees all groaned together, and the late afternoon sky turned darker blue, with streaks of crimson, with more pronounced clouds etched in deep gray, moving faster and more erratically than time-lapsed videos, and at ground level, the Valley of Dead Elms was shrouded in deepening yellow, non-electric warning light. And they creaked deeply and groaned together as the blade of my now ravenous saw approached the largest elm, the elder elm, and I cut a perfect V on the side where I wanted it to fall. And the wood smelled of life. I swallowed hard to soothe the dryness in my soul, then delivered one last painful, insulting incision on the other side. And it pivoted slightly this way and that, when it should have fallen, as the partially severed fibers of its body screamed at me in a deep and mournful voice and rebuked me in the language of tortured trees in no uncertain terms for not having the skill or forethought or both required to make the cut clean to end its life with honor and a little reverence, if only feigned. And I plunged my saw again into the side opposite the V, and in one deft and deliberate move, it seemed, the tree seized the blade in a death grip, creaked a pained sigh of relief, then became very still, as in a healing meditation, and I stood there stupidly, saw in hand still vibrating, motor running, blade at one with the trunk like a strand of barbed wire entombed in many bands of tree trunk growth. The sun laughed a purplish laugh, rolled over on its back on a nearby hill. The amber light took on a burnt orange hue as 100 black and furry creatures with eyes like glistening ebony marbles and flaps of skin like fine Spanish leather connecting their front and hind limbs danced crazily on the ground, running in and out of the hollows of fallen elms. Then climbing trees, jumping, screaming, and gliding about, swirling around me as I gripped my only false protection, still vibrating and wedged in the elder elm. And in the disappearing dusk, I was the intruder. The elms slapped me with their dying shadows. The flying squirrels gathered to stare at me, to pierce me, crucify me with their eyes. The left side of my body felt moist where I leaned against the elder elm and still held the saw, for fear that I would be carried off by the flying squirrels from hell if I let go, the flying squirrels that grew longer and fatter in the moonlight. I could see their teeth glistening now. And the left side of my body felt wet, my ear pressed to the smoothness of the dead gray wood. I heard the tree breathe moist, rattly breaths like 1,000 infants with coals. Then a sucking sound, and my left shoulder and arm were engulfed by the tree that had opened its sappy lips as long as I was tall. It kissed me mockingly and took in another inch of my body, then another, as an anaconda eats careless pigs. And I craned my neck to the right to keep my nose and mouth free, if only for another instant. And all the elms moved closer to form a perfect circle, and the black flying squirrels glided around me in the moonlight, and the elder elm sprouted buds, then baby leaves in the dead of night. Baby leaves of translucent, moonlit green with fine red veins, as I felt myself grow paler, fainter. My last decision, submit to the tree rather than fight it, as though a choice existed. The choice that disappeared with my first arrogant step into the place where the old farmer said, never go. This is Ken Haynes for Mind's Eye Radio.
In this show, we've been traveling through the territory between reality and unreality, the boundaries between the ordinary and the odd. But writer Paul Thompson suggests that perhaps we shouldn't even try to draw the distinction.
I possess both a deep skepticism about the paranormal and a craving to experience it. I would love to have a vision or see a flying saucer. But the only possible paranormal event in my life was an incident many years ago as a college student in Wisconsin. My parents were living in Florida. I was napping one afternoon and woke up to see my father standing at the foot of the cot. I didn't feel anything odd was happening. I just said, "Dad?" and went back to sleep. When I awoke again, of course, he was gone. Now, a good story demands that my father had died or something terrible happened that he was trying to warn me against. But, sorry, he was perfectly healthy. Nothing bad occurred. In short, there was no significance or point to his appearance. On the other hand, my minister tells of an elderly parishioner who was visited several times by the spirit of her dead husband. Now that's more like it. Science offers a raft of ex post facto explanations for such things. A psychologist might say that I dreamed my father and that the old lady was having senile hallucinations. Probably that's true. But such incidents remind us of Hamlet's observation that there are more things in heaven and earth, Horatio, than are dreamt of in your philosophy. We don't have to see ghosts or communicate telepathically with beings on planet X to experience the marvelous, though. Much we encounter in our daily, seemingly humdrum round of things is strange, wonderful, even frightening. But we manage not to see it that way. We build ourselves comfortable shells of perception and habit to protect us against reality and let us get on with our lives. Life itself is pretty odd when you come to think of it. The latest theory is that it started 3 miles down in the freezing depths of sea, next to volcanic cracks boiling out lava and smoke. Weird. And now it walks about on 2 legs and writes limericks. A few people, artists, poets, musicians, scientists, mystics, manage to break out of their shells and experience something of the utter strangeness and wonder of things. They see that the evening lies like a patient etherized upon a table, that white light splits into colors when passed through a prism, that a dark power throbs at the heart of things. It was that sense of the glowing mystery of existence, and a desire to say thank you for my opportunity to experience it, that drew me back to the church 5 or 6 years ago. I had been a secular agnostic. In my return, I didn't give up my agnosticism, just practiced it from inside the church rather than outside. It has evolved slowly into something else, not conviction, but more of a postulate that there is a source of love and strength on which we can draw. Where this will lead in the remaining years of my life, I don't know, but I'm looking forward to finding out. For Mind's Eye Radio, this is Paul Thompson.
You've been listening to Surreality Bites, written by the Mind's Eye Radio Collective in Madison, Wisconsin. The show was produced by Kelly Warren and co-produced by Sue Renard. Contributing writers include Esther Cameron, Ken Haynes, Louise Mancuso, Norma Gay Pruitt, Fran Rall, Sue Renard, Lynn Patrick Smith, Elena Tabachnik, Paul Thompson, Evie Thompson, Kelly Warren, Jackie Wilson, and Fran Zell. Original music by Barbara Chusid. Special thanks also to the musical group Dangerous Odds. If you'd like a copy of this show or would like more information about Mind's Eye Radio, call 608-256-6525 or catch our website at www.mindseyeaudio.com. Hey, do you know how many surrealists it takes to screw in a light bulb?
No, how many surrealists does it take to screw in a light bulb?
Fish.